Thanks for joining us here on Service to School Stories. Your hosts for this season are Alec Emmert, Service to School CEO and Navy veteran.
And Sydney Mathis, Chief Program Officer and former College Admissions Officer. This season, we'll cover topics as it relates to higher education, military service transition, and career opportunities and outcomes for veterans. Join us as we share student stories, inside tips from the admissions office, and conversations with employers actively hiring student veterans. Here we go.
It is a privilege to introduce today's guest, Bob Atkinson, who is an Air Force veteran, senior at Yale University, and both a Truman and Marshall Scholar. He's originally from Janesville, Minnesota. After graduating from high school, he enlisted in the U.S. Air Force and undertook special warfare training. He was the first Air Force member to be selected and directly assigned to the 75th Ranger Regiment's Regimental Reconnaissance Company. He conducted combat deployments to both Afghanistan and Iraq, and twice received the Bronze Star Medal for heroic or meritorious service. Atkinson wants to help shape U.S. drug policy, particularly by improving access to medication-assisted treatment and by eliminating the domestic opioid epidemic. He has been an intern at the Department of State's Bureau of Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, focusing on illicit drug supply reduction, and plans to pursue graduate studies at Oxford University, where he will earn a master's in philosophy and social and public policy. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Alec.
Yeah, good stuff. So I'd like to kick off by just asking about your background and what drew you to the military.
Yeah, so for me, I grew up in southern Minnesota, as you said, in a small town called Janesville. Pretty you know, rural upbringing. Went to a public school in the middle of nowhere, southern Minnesota, town of less than 2,000 people. Throughout my childhood, there was a lot of drug abuse in my household. Both my mother and my father struggled with that. And as I was graduating high school, times had gotten pretty tough. My parents had sort of split up. I had a younger brother that was still going to be in high school. My sister, she was older than me and had sort of moved to a town nearby, so wasn't directly in the household. But, started thinking about, how I was going to be able to sort of support, my brother moving forward and being able to help out my mom. And so that was a huge motivator for me. Originally, after graduating high school, I didn't just enlist right away. I ended up working at a group home where I essentially worked with vulnerable adults. It was a great experience. I worked there for a year, but I needed to, I started thinking more so about my future and sort of the impact I wanted to have. And I also thought it was going to be a really good thing for me to sort of leave where I had grown up and some of the things that I had been around for quite some years at that time. I guess family in short, and wanting to have an impact in the future were the big motivators for me to join the Air Force. So I joined in 2010, went down to basic training in Texas, went through, the whole, it wasn't called special warfare training at the time, but that now that's the word for what it is in terms of the pipeline that allows you to become a tactical air control party member, which is what I was. To speak broadly, there's four main tracks now, I believe, in the Air Force. My information is a bit dated, but at the time it was combat controllers, pararescue men, tactical air control party members, and it used to be, I believe it was like special, like weather folks, but now it's special reconnaissance, I believe is the name of the career field. So I ended up being a tactical air control party member, went through the rest of my pipeline, went down to Florida. Then I went and did my SEER training, went through basic airborne training in Fort Benning, went to my first assignment at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, was there for a couple of years, did one deployment out of there to Iraq. That would have been, I believe, in 2015 timeframe. So after that, I came back and ended up deciding that I wanted to, do something that was solely focused on special operations. So I decided to try out and go through the training course for the Regimental Reconnaissance Company, as you had mentioned previously. So I moved down to Fort Benning, Georgia, which is where that is. I went through the reconnaissance training course, which is roughly a year long. Went pretty well. I ended up being assigned to Team 1. And while I was down at Fort Benning, I did another four deployments, did three to Afghanistan and one to Iraq. And around, it would have been the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, which was when my last deployment to Afghanistan was, I decided that it was sort of time for me to transition from the military and do something else. And I think for me, it was a combination of, you know, professional and personal growth and really wanting to sort of emphasize the personal growth side, because I didn't feel like I had had that in quite some time, just, you know, sort of working in an environment that was very comfortable for me. But also I was thinking about it in terms of my age being, you know, roughly 30 years old at the time, and thinking about my marketability in other sectors moving forward. And I just thought it was a really good time at 10 years to sort of make that transition. So I applied to Yale, Columbia, and Brown. I ended up getting into all three of those programs. And I ended up choosing Yale mainly because at the time, and again, I don't know if this information is still the same, but really what I wanted was a small, non-traditional community that was more so an admissions process and not something that really houses you and sort of keeps you in a veteran world. I really wanted to be able to branch out, but also have the veteran resources when I needed them. And I thought that the Eli Whitney Students Program really provided that. Not to say that the others didn't, but I think that to the greatest degree, I thought that the Eli Whitney Students Program did it very well. And then the other thing for me was just, you know, given my background and the amount of income and the resources I had, very practically, the housing allowance that I got using my GI Bill really had the greatest impact for me in New Haven, just based on cost of living. So that was another big determinant. So came here, majored in global affairs. As you said, I've done an internship at the State Department and one at McKinsey, and it's been a great experience so far.
Fantastic. All right, man. So there is so much to unpack there. You've got such an incredible story. I'm actually going to rewind a little bit, and I've got a few just kind of follow-up questions. So, you know, one of the things that really struck me that you were talking about was your childhood, how you grew up in an environment where there was a lot of drug abuse. And I think, you know, we see situations where people grow up in those types of environments, and the majority of times people kind of mimic the behaviors they've been taught and seen. And then there's rare cases where people will get the strength to go against those negative influences and find a better path. And so in your case, you chose the latter. And I'd like to just hear a little bit about what helped you do that. Did you have mentors, or like what prevented you from going down, you know, a path of drug addiction and abuse?
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, like, it's important to acknowledge that environments are informative, and they were for me as well. I think that no matter what, when you're talking about children, especially children that are around like the ages of, I would say, like 7 and below, you know, no 7-year-old is some natural born leader. Like, I don't believe that. So I think that it definitely did affect me early on. You know, what you see your parents doing and what you see in your environment, you assume that is right, just because you don't have any other metric or experience. So I think I struggled early on, and as a kid, I didn't really have a really good idea of what, you know, strong leadership and being a good person really, really was at the time. However, I think that for me, because I kind of grew up in an environment where I had a younger brother and then I had a sister that both sort of viewed me as like the leader of the children of my household. And, you know, that was interesting, you know, looking back on it, because I think that to be a good leader, you have to be a good follower first and really understand, you know, what leadership is, and also how to be a good subordinate. And I didn't really do that early on. And I think that what allowed me to sort of take the path, you know, a better path, as you said, was not only like sort of navigating that within my family, but then as I transitioned into being able to participate in sports, hang out with friends, you know, meet their parents, and also be a member of the community and have people to lean on that really rallied around me as a kid as well. I think that those were huge and extremely instrumental for me to take the path that I did. So to sum that up, I think coaches for one, but also the parents. You know, I gave a Veterans Day speech at Yale a few months ago, and one of the things I talked about were, you know, the Bornicke and Westfall families. And those, I had two really good friends growing up, still good friends today. They're Nate and Jesse. And their parents, I think, were also extremely helpful. And I don't think that I would have been able to do it without them. So in short, I think there's no such thing as self-made. And I think that there were people around me that really helped out.
Gotcha. And so it was that kind of that community you found yourself in, the sense of responsibility you had being the oldest sibling, that gave you kind of the focus to have a clear path, stay clear of negative destructive influences and kind of move forward. And so that's really inspirational. Do you get home much, or how have you leveraged the experience you've had, and how you relate back to people in your hometown or people you knew then?
Yeah, I think
when you're growing up.
Well, I think it depends on the time period, especially I think right as I joined the military, I was focused on training and getting to my first duty station. And then once I got there, I really wanted to be good at my job and thrive in that environment. So I don't think that at the very beginning I came home very much. However, I think after I had sort of like made it through all the training and sort of established myself and figured out how to do things efficiently, this would have been probably around, I would say 2013. I had went through all of my training and sort of been, I was like certified as a tactical air control party member and everything around 2012. And then I went through Ranger School at the end of 2012 as an Air Force guy. And after that, I feel like I sort of had more time to be able to go home for a while until my first deployment. So I think I maximized it then. However, again, once that first deployment happened to Iraq, and then all of that time up until 2020, the ops tempo, alert status, all of the things that you have to do, especially in the special operations community, really dictate your lifestyle. And quite frankly, there's a lot of times where you're so busy that, the idea of getting on a plane after being on a plane for a long time is just not what you're looking for. So that whole time period of 2020, I came home probably once a year. Since I've been at Yale, I've gotten to go home a little bit more. And I also think, to answer the second part of your question about how I've been able to connect, I don't think I've ever lost sight of where I came from. And I certainly don't like to come home and talk about just everything I'm doing all of the time in the world I'm living in now. In fact, I think it's been much more effective to be able to stay close with the people where I'm from by being empathetic and also trying to sort of understand what they do day to day. And then again, not losing sight of where I came from. So I think humility is probably baked into that as well, but empathy more than anything else.
Yeah, that's so inspiring. And you talked about your Air Force training cycle, and I wanted to touch a little bit on that, right? Because every branch of the military has got a special operations component, and the Air Force is one of the most, if not the most, I believe, selective in terms of like attrition rates, the length of the pipeline, its difficulty, but it's not very well celebrated, I think, or very well known, because everybody kind of knows about SEALs, knows about Rangers, knows about Green Berets, but nobody really knows about the special operators in the Air Force. And so I think it would be awesome if you could just give like a little bit more background on like what the training was like to become an Air Force special operator, what it all took, the type of missions you did and all that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there, and there's so much nuance to it. So I'm going to try and keep it super, super high level. Also, again, I want to make sure that I state, I think my information is dated in terms of, I went through the training 2011 to 2012 timeframe. Mm-hmm. The pipeline has adapted a lot. And so I just want to acknowledge that. I would say just, you bring up a really good point about how known, Air Force Special Tactics is. And I think a big part of that is historically, Air Force Special Tactics members have been, attached, have always augmented other special operations forces that make up the main effort, whether that be, Green Berets, SEALs, Rangers, you name it. And so I think that has something to do with it. So, some of that is size and scope. However, I do think that since then, there have been a lot of moves to sort of create more like Air Force organic special operations teams. So not sure where that is today, but I think that that's been something they've been trying to do for quite some time now. So we'll see where that takes the notoriety of the organizations. In terms of the training itself, in at least in 2011, the way that it had worked was that you would essentially go through basic training, and then you would do like an indoctrination course for whichever career path you were taking. So some of that was it was the weather thing, SOUTI, Special Operations Weather, I think, technician. So there was PJs, SOUTIs, CCTs, which are your combat controllers, and then TACPs, which is what I did. And each of those had an indoctrination course. And then you sort of have different pipelines of training that happen for each one of those. So for me, you would do your indoc course, and then you would get sent down to Florida as a TACP, and you would train in Hurlburt Field. And essentially, I think you spent around 6 months training how to become a TACP. The CCTs did it a bit different. They would go to Mississippi for a while, and then they would bounce around as well and do a lot of different specialized training. PJ spent some time, would spend some time in Texas, and then they would end up going on to, I believe it was Albuquerque, New Mexico eventually, but they did some training as well. And then SOUTIs, to be honest, I think they had followed the CCT track for some time and had something separate. So that the reason I bring that up is because although they're all in the special tactics, you know, space, each of the training pipelines are very different, and they're meant to be different based on each career path's duties. Now, I bring that up because that was the 2011 era. Now that they've sort of formalized this special warfare training pipeline, I believe that at least for the, you know, significant portion of the beginning of the training, all of those career paths are going through their indoctrination process together, and then they sort of branch out afterwards. So I think they're trying to formalize it more as a pipeline for all the career paths. And I also think it's important to note that TACPs at the time, there was an interesting relationship where you would, after going through your course, like for me, I went to Fort Bragg, and you would start out working as a conventional TACP until you've sort of done your apprentice time to try out being special operations. I think that to a certain extent, that's still the case today. And that differs significantly from what, you know, CCTs, PJs, and SOUTIs, what they had done in 2011, where they would go through their initial training and they would immediately go and work in the special tactics community. So there was a difference in terms of how you sort of build up someone to become an NCO in the special operations community. So it wasn't guaranteed if you became a TACP, whereas it was guaranteed if you went the other path to work in special operations.
Gotcha. Yeah, and so that's really interesting to me because, and, you know, I never really thought of it like that, because when you think about it, you know, all SEALs go through, you know, BUDS, SQT, Rangers, you know, they go through whatever, I think like RASP it's called, and then Ranger School. And it's like every one of those communities is like a very set path, a very set mission. Whereas the Air Force, like you're talking about, these are very specialized skills that you go through a demanding pipeline to acquire, and then you use those skills to augment, or like what you're saying generally in your time, we're used to augment other units that have broader skill bases. Is that like a good way to think about it?
I think so, until, you know, there are certain organizations, especially, you know, like for instance, if you were to go through the reconnaissance training course as an Air Force person, at least when I was going through, on one hand, you're still a TACP, and for me, you know, part of the 17th Special Tactics Squadron, but assigned to a team at the Regimental Reconnaissance Company. It's interesting because after going through that training, and once you start working with like more elite special operations, it becomes much more muddied and gray, where you're not really fulfilling your traditional duties as a TACP. Now you're just a team member doing the same thing as the other guys, but also having the capabilities that you bring as a, you know, as a force multiplier, you know, especially as a JTAC. And I think that that's the case for a lot of the other career paths as well, depending on what units they go to. So yes, in a sense, I do think that there's that augmented relationship, but there's definitely some gray area as you start to move up in the tiers in terms of what's being asked of you as an Air Force special operator.
Gotcha. Oh, cool. I'm going to just switch gears a little bit to talk about your transition out of the military. And you mentioned the schools you were looking at. And a big question we get a lot is, how soon before I'm discharged do I have to start planning my transition? And can you kind of just give our listeners a little bit about a little bit on the timeline you took, like, you know, separation, minus 1 year, you did X, you know, minus 6 months, you did Y, like that kind of plan that you followed to successfully transition out.
Yeah, well, not to be corny, but, you know, you should always have multiple courses of action, right? And I think, this might not be a satisfying answer, but I do think you should always be planning your transition, no matter where you are, as you're, you know, in the military, whether you're enlisted or an officer. I think for me, in terms of like more tactically, when I started actually doing things, that probably happened around, you know, probably 2 years out, before I started actually putting pen to paper and started working those applications. But definitely I would say 2 years is comfortable. And as you start to get, you know, closer to your separation date, that's when I think your timeline gets to become much more compact. You lose flexibility. You might miss out on some of the application processes. But some of that is also dependent on the date of when you're separating too, unfortunately. And that's, if you're trying to transition to, and I'm taking this as if you're planning to transition and go to school, you know, based on some of the academic timelines for admissions, you know, when you separate can definitely influence how far out you should be planning. However, what I would say is, especially for the enlisted folks, if you don't have a history of education, especially at the college level, or if you have a history of education, but it's, you know, your transcript is not what you want it to be, then you need to start planning much further out to sort of build that, you know, that body of good work and, you know, high capability and like all of these good grades, to where when you're applying, it's like you've shown a body of work that would suggest you're going to thrive at a top university. So if that's the case and you haven't, you know, necessarily taken all of those classes, I would recommend starting it like 3 years out. And that can be, you know, that can be online classes. That doesn't have to be doing anything, you know, in person at a community college. But I think it's important to have something to show for. So for me specifically, I started doing online classes while I was in and while I was deployed, because I knew that I needed to be able to build like some sort of, you know, body of data to prove that, you know, I'm going to succeed when I come to Yale. So for me, it was 3 years. And then as I was about 2 years out, I started to think about options, and it wasn't all just academic. I also thought about, you know, professional options, you know, all of the different things, whether that was jobs, you know, entrepreneurship. I thought about a lot of different ideas, but school was the best for me. And I think 2 years is definitely comfortable. It gives you time to not start building your application, but like looking for options that exist and being able to like prioritize and rack and stack that. And then once you figure out like the requirements, like it gives time to like get letters of recommendation, write your essays, seek resources like service to school. I think all of those like really take time. So I think that that's probably what I would recommend.
Excellent. And going back to the courses you talked about, so did you take classes ahead of your application, college level classes? And if so, which ones and in what format?
Yeah, well, tough. So I don't remember exactly what the classes I took were, and I don't know what that says about me or the classes I was taking. I took a lot of classes, and I was taking them at, I believe, AMU at the time, and I was doing them online while I was deployed. And so it was in an online format. In my classes, especially at AMU, they never met. So it was like you had like essentially just like things that you had to do and assignments to take care of. I don't know if that's still the format, but yeah, I tried to take as many as I could without, you know, really overloading. And I think it was just a really good way to be able to show that although these classes definitely don't measure up to some of the ones that I've, you know, been taking at Yale, in terms of like how, you know, rigorous your schedule is and how rigorous the academics were, they at least proved that number one, I was intellectually curious and like was interested in academics, but also like willing to do the work and build, you know, a body of data. So that's how the format I did it in.
Awesome. That's really helpful. The application process, you touched on it a little bit, but what I'd like to hear about is veterans and how you leverage your fellow veterans to help you succeed in that application process and the type of resources you use to get into school.
Yeah, ooh. I'm really trying to think back. I think for me, I would say it was a mix. So I used veterans resources to even find out that Service to School existed. And I actually used Service to School while I was applying. For me, the resource that I leveraged the most was there was a tutor that essentially would look over some of my writing materials that I was going to be applying with, like my personal statement. And that was, immensely helpful. I felt like I knew how to write, having been in the military for 10 years and written a lot of things. Having done school before that, but the writing that you're used to in the military just does not translate to, applications when you're like applying to a university. And I think that, maybe some people can get away with doing it on their own and writing differently, but I think it's a resource that you should leverage when you're getting out. So Service to School was super helpful for me in that way. And so I had someone really help me out with my writing style. And I would say also, like, in terms of veteran resources, most of them for me were very informal. I spoke to folks that I knew that went to school in the Northeast and talked to them about universities that I was looking at. And I think that, especially some of the officers that I chatted with that had a lot of experience in the Northeast and a couple that went to Ivy League institutions were very helpful in guiding me towards Yale. And I think that there's just a lot that you learn about academia and the culture and also the difference in opportunities depending on where you go, that you can learn from people that have been there, that you probably won't be able to figure out if you're just surfing the internet. And I think that, like, for instance, one of the things I learned when I was talking to, an officer that I'd worked with was that at Yale, a lot of times the graduate students and the professional school students sort of like attend undergraduate classes and vice versa. And I thought that was really cool because it'd be interesting to not only go to school with folks that were 10 years younger than me, but also individuals that were my same age. And I was sort of drawn to that and also drawn to the idea of being able to go to classes at different graduate schools at Yale. So I think that for me, again, it was more informal, but valuable nonetheless.
Gotcha. And we'd like to get a little bit more info on specifically the Eli Whitney program. We know it's for non-traditional students. We had Jimmy Hatch, was a former Navy SEAL who was Eli Whitney program student, came and talked at our VetLink Summit. And so I'd like to get a little bit more information for our listeners about who exactly is competitive for that program, what it is, and really like what it looks like for a Yale student.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, shout out to Jimmy. Jimmy's awesome. I want to avoid saying who's competitive and who's not. I think that for me, I don't know that I'm qualified to say that. I think that if you're interested in it, you should absolutely apply. And I also think that you should attend an info session and talk with some of some of the people that work in admissions. Ms. Patricia Way is one that comes to mind, and she's been amazing for me as well since I've been here, and she's very helpful when talking about the admissions process for veterans. So the program, the application process, I believe has changed, and it's not a veteran only program, which I think is important to highlight. So there are people that were professional dancers before they came to Yale, some of which were in the Olympics. That's historically been the case, and also a lot of other various backgrounds. And all of the students that are in the program are non-traditional because they're older and they didn't go straight from high school to Yale. What I think is important to sort of talk about is the difference between what you may assume the Eli Whitney Students Program and then what I think it is. So the Eli Whitney Students Program, first and foremost, is an admissions process. It is a way to apply as a non-traditional student to get into Yale. It is highly selective. It is not, once you're a student at Yale, you are viewed no different than a traditional student day to day, and you take classes the same way. However, I think that there are a lot of perks to the Eli Whitney Students Program. You know, for instance, if you're married and you have kids, it is definitely flexible in terms of how many classes that you're required to take per semester. You also have 7 years to complete your undergraduate education at Yale, which is pretty awesome, especially if you have other obligations such as a family. The requirement, I believe, is taking a credit and a half per semester to stay enrolled. I will say the credits at Yale are a little different than most schools. To graduate as an undergraduate, you need to graduate with 36 credits. And most classes have one credit per class, which I know is different because a lot of universities, I think it's like 4 credit classes.
Yeah.
But that's, yeah, if you do the math, it ends up being pretty much the same, but every class is 1 credit. And so that's, so a credit and a half per semester translates to taking roughly 2 classes to stay enrolled. So that makes it extremely flexible as well. The other thing that's great about the program is once you're admitted, it's an extremely small cohort that allows you to really, you know, make what you want of it. There are students that are super involved. There is an Eli Whitney students group. Essentially, it's almost like a little society of Eli Whitney students that hang out pretty much every other week. And so if you really want to take part in all of those events, and a lot of them are really awesome, then you absolutely can do that. If you decide that you don't want to, you know, hang out so much with the Eli Whitney students group, you can fully immerse yourself in the traditional student community. And so I think that's really cool that you have the flexibility to make what you want of it. Another thing that's interesting is at Yale, there's residential colleges. So it's essentially, if you get into Yale, there's residential colleges within Yale that have housing. And if you meet a certain, age requirement, you really want to live in the residential colleges and have the traditional undergraduate experience, you can now do that. I've heard recently, and I don't know this for sure, but I would confirm it, that the Eli Whitney Students Program only admits cohorts for the fall of each academic year. So that's something to keep in mind when you're going through the application process. So I would just say pay attention to the dates and good luck to anybody that wants to apply. Definitely recommend. It's been awesome.
Awesome. You know, good stuff. And then what I'd like to get some more information on is the process you took, because you got 2 very prestigious scholarships. And I'd like to hear about the process for both of them. So first, you got the very, very rarely do we ever talk. One of these is a big deal. The fact that you got 2 is incredible. And so for our listeners, we'd like to get some information on, first the Truman Scholarship, what the application process for it was like, what it entails and what drew you to it.
Well, the Truman Scholarship, in case, folks aren't aware of it, I didn't know what it was until I believe like my junior year, so wouldn't be surprised. Essentially, it is a national level scholarship that you apply for during your junior year. And it's given essentially for individuals that are interested in pursuing a career in public service. It is essentially President Truman's living legacy, which makes him very different from other presidents. A lot of presidents have statues built after them and in their memory. President Truman decided to have a scholarship being his living memorial. So it's really cool. It is a $30,000 scholarship that is used for graduate school. And essentially the requirement is that if you receive the Truman Scholarship, you're committing yourself to 3 years of public service of the 7 years after graduate school. I know that's like a mouthful, but yes. So in the 7 years after graduate school, 3 of those have to be in public service. And that's defined in a lot of nuanced ways, but it was an awesome opportunity. Essentially, you apply for it through your university. Your university endorses you. They submit you forward to the national committee. And then you interview if you're selected for the Truman Scholarship in person in your region. And every year, I think they select approximately, I think it's around 60 students to be a Truman Scholar. After that, you'll attend Truman Scholars, I believe, Truman Scholars Leadership Week, which is down in Missouri. And it was a great experience as well. And for me, the reason I applied for it was because I do see myself working in public service after my graduate school time. So the 3-year commitment to me didn't seem all that big because it's what I want to do anyway. And I just thought it was an awesome opportunity and I could use, you know, any additional funding moving forward.
Gotcha. And so what does the application timeline look like? At what point in your academic career is it ideal to apply for it? Is it something you do in your sophomore year, your junior year, et cetera? And what does the application itself look like?
Yeah. Well, you apply your junior year. And I want to say you apply at the end of the fall semester in your junior year. The application, it kind of differs, I think, actually the application to the Truman Foundation is going to be the same across any applicant, but I believe every university has different requirements for the endorsement process.
Okay.
So for Yale, you apply through Yale, and you actually have to interview for your endorsement at the university before you're even submitted forward. Usually it's I believe Yale does it in a way where you actually do your entire Truman application and then they just use that. So you just submit it afterwards, which I think makes the most sense, but I think different schools do it differently. What I was going to say is essentially it is a super rigorous application. Very comprehensive. So it's, transcripts. I believe you do 3 letters of recommendation. You have to fill out a bunch of different biographical data. Some of that, on top of that, you're also filling out your public service, in the past public service, internships, volunteer work. And then I want to say there's 7, maybe 8 essays that you have to complete at the end of your application. And each of those have a character limit. And they range from, a leadership essay to essentially a personal statement at the end, even though it's not worded as a personal statement, I don't think. But the essays are pretty pretty tough, actually. A couple of them are focused on your academic plans and your professional plans moving forward. And I don't want to step into, or I don't want to answer questions for the Truman Foundation, but it seems to me, or the questions suggest, that they're very interested in how your academic plans tie into what you plan to do professionally and the impact that you're trying to have. And so I think that, to me, it seems very clear that they want to see a very clear narrative of where you want to pursue your academics and then your plans moving forward to create that impact. And whether or not fit-wise you actually, fit the mold of someone that really does want to pursue a career in public service. And so, yeah, it's pretty rigorous. And for me, it was, it was a great experience because I do think that whether or not, if you win the Truman, that's obviously great. But even if you don't, I found the process to be extremely valuable just to be able to put a lot of your thoughts to paper and really create a plan for yourself. And it helped me moving forward in classes, but also applying for the Marshall Scholarship as well and the Tillman. So
very cool. And then so one prestigious postgraduate scholarship was not enough. So you went for 2. So tell us about the Marshall process. And first off, what is the Marshall Scholarship, and then how you applied for it?
Yeah, so the Marshall Scholarship is another national level scholarship. This one you apply for at Yale, and this might not be the same everywhere, but I applied for endorsement actually during the summer between my junior and senior year, which I almost missed the deadline for that because I just, it was the summer and I was doing other things, working at McKinsey. And I ended up submitting an application for endorsement during that time. Before I get into that, the scholarship itself is essentially, it's given to individuals that are rising seniors that want to attend any university in the UK for 2 years or 1 year. It's very similar in some ways to the Rhodes Scholarship, and they both have a very similar construct. The difference is what the Marshall Scholarship looks for versus what the Rhodes Scholarship looks for. and I might misquote this, but I believe the Marshall Scholarship is given based on leadership potential, academic ability, and ambassadorial potential. And I don't know what the Rhodes requirements are because I did not apply for it. However, that's really what the Marshall looks for. I think something that might be interesting for folks that are listening to the podcast is that the Rhodes Scholarship has an age limit for application. So for the Rhodes, I believe the age is either 26 or 27. So if you're over that, you can't apply. So I was not eligible for that. Whereas the Marshall does not have an age limit. However, it provides, you know, very similar resources. So I was super excited to apply for it. The things that the Marshall gives you is it allows you to go to school at any university in the UK for 2 years or 1 year. It provides you it funds the entire program tuition wise. There's also a stipend for your living expenses, for food and things of that sort. So it's actually a great opportunity, and it's usually given to approximately 50 students every year. It's very similar. After you apply, you need your university's endorsement, and then they submit you forward to essentially it's the national committee, and then each region does interviews after that. So for me, I applied for the Midwest region. So after I was endorsed and then selected to interview, I had to fly from New Haven to Chicago and do an in-person interview at the British consulate there. That's another important thing is that British Parliament is very involved in the Marshall Scholarship. So I did an interview there. You basically sit in the front of a desk in front of, you know, seven people that are experts in their various fields, and they talk to you and interview you for what you applied for. I will tell you, in terms of all of the interviews I've done for scholarships, whether that was the Truman, the Tillman, or the Marshall, this was by far like the toughest one that I did, but it was an awesome experience, and it definitely tested me. After that, you leave, you fly back to New Haven, and then you find out if you want it. So I flew back, and then I want to say it was about 2 weeks later, I ended up getting a phone call to find out that I won the Marshall Scholarship, and I plan to use that, as you said before, to attend Oxford. And I'd like to pursue an MPhil in evidence-based social intervention and policy evaluation. And I think the last thing that I'll say about it was just that after you receive the Marshall Scholarship, or if you receive the Rhodes actually as well, you apply through the university that you are trying to attend. Where the Marshall differs a lot from the Rhodes is that the Rhodes is only for Oxford, whereas the Marshall you can use for any school in the UK. So for me, I still had to go through the entire application process for the University of Oxford. So I applied about a month ago, and we'll see if I end up succeeding in that.
Yeah, very, very cool. And we'd like to just get some thoughts on where you see your courses going. Like, you know, you mentioned the degree program you're in. But I'm interested in hearing some of the classes you're thinking about taking and how you would like to use them to further your career and your long-term goals.
Yeah, well, complicated stuff. Right now, so most of the classes that I've taken at Yale have been, so I majored in global affairs. Most of the classes I've taken have been, you know, either in like the economic space or in the foreign policy space. And, you know, that's been extremely it's been an awesome time here. I've been able to leverage a lot of the experiences that I had in the military, but also learn, you know, a whole lot about foreign policy and how, you know, economics ties into that. I'm interested in U.S. drug policy, and I'm also interested in international drug policy as well. And so while I'm doing my MPhil at Oxford, that's what I plan to focus on. You know, for me, I think that there's an opportunity to do a lot of studies comparing and contrasting drug policies in the UK versus drug policies in the US. So right now I'm sort of trying to craft a really clear and concise thesis for what I'm trying to pursue with that. In terms of the classes that I'm planning on taking, while at Oxford, I'm looking to take the policy evaluation track, which is, again, very nuanced. It's within the program that I applied for, but I'd like to learn how to use interdisciplinary ways and econometrics to sort of assess you know, whether or not policies are effective or ineffective and how to make them effective, and just really use data to drive that. In terms of what I'm trying to do long term, I haven't exactly nailed that down 100%. I would like to work like in that space in some capacity. Whether or not I do that in the U.S. or on an international platform, you know, we'll see where that goes. But long term, I would like to be able to affect illicit drug supply reduction and sort of do that in a way that also benefits national security. So I'm not sure if that's going to be working in the policy space exclusively or working more in a counter-narcotics capacity, if that makes sense.
It does. Bob, I'm going to turn it over to you to have the final word. Would like to just get any of your final thoughts, advice you have for our listeners, or really anything you'd like to share before we wrap it up.
Yeah, first and foremost, I just want to say thank you to you for having me. It's been a pleasure. And I think that, you know, I want to give a plug for Service to School first. I think it was super helpful for me, you know, trying to get into Yale. And I think that as veterans, we have a tendency to try to do everything on our own as we're trying to, you know, pursue the next thing. And that is like, although, you know, I commend you for that, if that's the path that you're trying to go down, I highly recommend that you use all of the resources available if you're trying to pursue education after military service. So, you know, lean on Service to School, lean on its resources. That's what it's there for. And it'll help you a lot moving forward. I guess the next thing I would say is just, you know, I would say if you do pursue education, for instance, at a university like Yale, it really doesn't matter what university you go to. There are veteran communities that exist, and that network is extremely strong. And, you know, your service is something that's going to make you, you know, better when you're pursuing education. And it's something that's going to really, like, inform your leadership moving forward. So don't forget where you came from, and best of luck moving forward.
Awesome. Bob, thank you so much for your time. It's been an honor and a privilege to talk to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Alec.
That's all we have for this episode. Join us next week, same time, same place, where we share more Service to School stories. Service to School Stories is hosted by Sydney Mathis, Chief Program Officer, and Alec Emmert, Service to School CEO. Our podcast is produced and edited by our Director of Communication, Amanda Tobias. Service to School is a 501c3 nonprofit providing free college admission support to transitioning service members and veterans. Join us next week and follow us for more on your favorite social media platforms.